Schien für das Dach. So, das ist doch gut.
Thank you.
straightforward there. We don't know each other very well, so
no, we can talk about international
that.
Things. I'm also
Yeah. Yeah. Okay.
That's fine. Yeah. All right.
More
This is our second one in our series on curating the transnational. And I'm really pleased that today we have two big guns managed to secure their services. I'm very delighted about that. Our chief guest is Venu Dupa. Who is a patron of the ASHA Foundation and Minorities of Europe. She led the development of the Creative Innovation Unit at the South Bank Center and has held the post of Director of Arts and Creativity for the British Council. Fellowship Director at MESTA, Chief Executive at the Nottingham Playhouse, and producer, mobile touring at the National Theatre. 1999, she was appointed as the inaugural chair of the East Midlands Cultural Consortium by the Secretary of State at the Department of Culture, Media and Sport, a role she held until 2002. She has been awarded the prestigious Asian Woman of Achievement Award for contribution to the arts and culture. And today's conversation partner is Professor Chris Wainwright, who is our head of college.
I just stop now while we're in front, don't you? Okay, well, sorry, like a cough. I mean, first of all, this is the first of the training sessions that I've been to, so I'm here sort of not quite aware of the sort of temperature of discussions that usually happen here, so I'm just going to kind of talk about things as I experience them, as I feel them, and as I've been involved, and I think we'll probably both do the same. It's also just to say thanks for inviting us, and I'll try and come to more of these, but sit in that part of the room is more often than sit in this part of the room. One of the reasons that I thought it would be interesting for us to have a discussion. I hope it will be a discussion and not so much a sort of series of dislocated presentations, is that, as some of you may know, or may soon know, we're looking at establishing a graduate school here at Camberwell, Chelsea and Wimbledon. And one of the things that I've been very keen on exploring is how we can establish an environment that harnesses research thinking and taught postgraduate study in a more kind of recyclable format, in the sense that we have quite rightly a lot of research initiatives which are going on through the research centres and research units that are looking substantially outside of the institution and creating work and creating discourse that is about a broader cultural environment. And we have a taught postgraduate environment, which I think historically, not just in this institution but many others, is rooted in a kind of undergraduate experience. So in other words, one is kind of located internally and through that kind of taught process, and the other has its kind of axis very much in relation to the broader external world. That might be an oversimplification, but I'll use it for the basis of a sort of discussion, really. And what I'm interested in is how we can somehow expand the relationship between those two sets of experiences in a way that maybe makes sense of some of our research imperatives as informing some of that taught postgraduate experience, and also relates some of the taught postgraduate experience more broadly culturally than it might be at the moment. And one of the things that I'm interested in exploring is the potential for what, again, is for the sake of discussion, something that might be broadly termed a thematic inquiry, that might be a way of bringing together different communities of people across that notion of a graduate school. And one of the discussions that we've started, albeit tentatively, is what place there is within art schools, what responsibility there is within art schools for taking hold of key thematic debates that have their relevance to a broader cultural, to a broader social and political environment. And I think from that starting point, the platform that you've created here might be a good place to develop notions of thematic inquiry related to identity, related to cultural imperatives. So that's my interest, is to sort of see if out of this debate we can start to gain some sense of what an art school's responsibility might be in the broader sense of its engagement. So that's how I'll sort of
start
the process.
I suppose a good way for me to start is to say that I associate this place with visual art, and my background isn't visual art, my background is in theatre. And then creativity more widely. And I'm interested in how creativity can be harnessed for scholarship. But I don't mean scholarship in the traditional sense of how many papers can I write and how much study can I accumulate. I'm interested in how creativity can help us in the pursuit of knowledge and the pursuit of solutions. And so I think that's where our interests cross, because I think thematic inquiry is a very good way of putting it.
Okay.
And I guess what's taken me to my different roles has been part curiosity, but part trying to come at different situations from a different angle to see whether we can progress.
Can I pick up on the sort of tactic there? I mean, you've chosen, like many of us have chosen, to work within an institutional context, and I'm kind of interested in some of the experiences of different institutional, if you like, kind of traditions and perspectives about their role and function, and the kind of fracturing that exists when that institution is challenged with something. Which is about looking at new partnerships, looking at new ways of thinking. Why have you chosen to work in institutions to try and achieve that, as opposed to a more independent spirit of kind of development?
Well, I pick my institutions quite carefully. I don't just go and work in institutions.
Right.
And actually, I don't really like working in institutions very much. So I tend to have periods when I work in institutions and periods when I don't. And okay, so the first institution I worked in was the National Theatre, and I was never interested in working in the National Theatre as an actor, because I'd been an actress for 7 years, but I was never really, the National Theatre wasn't a place I aspired to, which is unusual, I suppose. But when an opportunity came up there after some time to go and actually try and make some changes in the institution itself, I was attracted to that, because I think we do have the formulas, I think we generally have the formulas wrong in our institutions, in terms of making the best work or enabling the best work. And so rather than bang on the door from the outside, I think you can systematically make change in institutions. So the National Theatre was somewhere where I did a lot of work around audience development, because I was very interested in more people seeing what good work. But also thinking about what that work was. And the National Theatre at that time had a very, well, actually still does, it's a very white institution. And so I thought bringing some different cultural sensibilities would be interesting. And I was able to attack audience development in a different way at the National Theatre. And then at Nottingham Playhouse, I was able to then make policy, which made a very big difference to, we might call it intercultural practice and policy. So for example, we put in place the first integrated casting policy in the UK, and that is now available for any other theatre that wants to use it. While I was there, we were the first theatre to join the European Theatre Forum. So we were saying that Europe was important, we were signalling we wanted to become involved in European exchange. Previously Britain had been thought of as rather stuffy and ignoring Europe, and we were talking earlier about the importance of that, both in your work and my work now, in terms of accessing funds and enabling partnerships. And then in NESTA, the National Endowment for Science, Technology and the Arts, NESTA was a new institution, and so that there was tremendous potential there to do new things in new and different ways, and not infantilise the artist in the way that so many of our institutions do. So thinking about why artists should be responsible, and how they could be responsible, and not in this kind of dependent relationship with the state. That was a tremendously exciting place, and there was a real opportunity there to introduce internationalism into a new and quite large and influential organisation. And then I kind of ducked out for a while, because although I was working at Southbank Centre and getting that institution to think about what a world cultural centre was rather than a presenting house with several different garages, what are the responsibilities of a world cultural centre, and how can you use that to make relationships with the society around you rather than just be a space where people show things and then go, and there's no real legacy. So I was involved in the thinking there. I was doing a series of sort of international projects, but I didn't really have to work through the institution, and we can come on to that, how you debunk institutional structures. And then at the British Council, huge challenge, but I didn't really get on with that institution very well.
Okay.
Well, we can talk about that more as well.
That's a fairly enigmatic phrase, which we'll come back to maybe later. But I mean, something I just wanted to suggest, and I think we've had similar experiences of working in institutions which, I think, over a period of time, have endlessly developed policy and endlessly reviewed policy. But I just wonder whether or not you think that's had any effect materially in relation to the effort that's gone into creating policy. I think of institutions like the Arts Council, which you know, seem to review policy almost on a daily basis as one of their main kind of reasons for being in existence. And I've certainly been involved in debates from the mid-80s onwards about how we must continue to strive for notions of equality, notions of representation, notions of inclusion. And those policies seem to get more and more sophisticated every day. Yet actually, I wonder if they actually have ever reached their potential in terms of implementation. And it seems to me, I mean, that's why I asked the question about responsibility. Who is responsible? I actually don't think institutions tend to be that responsible, because they're often satisfied with policy and strategy and don't actually have the wherewithal or the ability to implement the strategy. I mean, is your experience different to that?
I think that Nesta was different.
Yeah.
I think organisations and institutions tend to take the view that the only way to the only way policies can be developed and work is top down, in my experience. So a few people at the top of the organisation will have a few good ideas and then set up rather technocratic structures where they invent all the rules and all the criteria, and then they kind of put out these opportunities. And the artists or creative individuals are at the bottom of a rather long tree of criteria and have to negotiate their way through competitively rather than collaboratively, and are unhelpfully pitted against each other. And if you're a good artist, you're patted on the head and given a small amount of money and told to go away unless you know someone, and then you're given a bit more money. And if you're a naughty artist and don't meet any of the criteria, you're just told to go away. And so there's no notion that policy can be developed from the bottom up or practice leading policy. And I think that's a shame. I think that's a big mistake.
Mm-hmm.
Because I think much of the creative talent is in that view of the world is at the bottom, and spends quite a lot of time and effort trying to attract and affect the attention of the people at the top in order to try and affect then the policies and rules and regulations. And that was what we were trying to turn on its head at Nesta, where we were essentially trying to give creative people as much freedom as possible within some given parameters, and some steerage and support to let them realise their work, but then track the impacts of their work some way down the line, rather than have. I mean, I don't really understand why you would bother to research or explore something if you know what the answers are. And so Nesta was about saying, you have a hunch, you are talented, you have a track record, go and explore it.
Where does that philosophy come from? Why is Nesta like that? And why are many of our funding councils that we refer to maybe have completely the opposite?
Well, Nesta is no longer like that.
Why? What? Give us a bit of background about why you think Nesta was successful.
I think.
How did it get away with it, for instance? How did
Nesta, it got away with it partly because a visionary chief executive called Jeremy Newton, who's now the principal at RADA, and a massive talent, and what he said. What he decided to do was to bring in people into his executive structure who had been practitioners, and people who were willing to take risks, and who were willing to develop solutions to issues identified by the industry. And so that meant we had to work very closely with creative people in order to design and develop the way forward. But you had to have a confidence with the generic issues around creativity without saying you knew it all. Because one day I was working with an astrophysicist, and the next day I was working with a visual artist, and the next day I was working with someone who was designing tents for refugees. So you were required to be rooted in a specialism and have your knowledge generated from a specialism, but then engage in intelligent debate with a wide variety. Different people and different approaches. And that persisted for about 5 years. And And then we were audited by the National Audit Office, you know, who thought it was visionary, but at that time the Treasury was exerting pressure for results, and, you know, they just, you know, they gave us a hard time. And Dave Putnam, a visionary chairman as well, who had achieved creatively and understood the stuff of creativity, moved on. And somebody who'd run an advertising agency, the financial side of an advertising agency, came in, and it's now become a sort of creative industries policy think tank.
So it's become much more output driven.
Yes, well, I'm not sure about output driven. I think it's probably outputting less, but it's it's different outputs. But I think the brilliant thing about Nesta, because it's an endowment, it can take on the personality of the staff. It's open to interpretation, and it's so valuable because it's almost the only one of its kind. And so it can change. And so, you know, who knows, in the future it could be something else.
Mm.
It's a very empowering institution to work for.
Okay. And you move from there.
But what about, why do you mentioned your experience in research and with the research councils, and that being policy driven from the top. Maybe it would be good for you, for
I think many of us live in that sort of environment. And I mean, just to summarise my sense of that is that, you know, we're living in a time when we have to, as you indicated, identify what the research questions are quite specifically. Nothing wrong with that, but also to almost predict what the outcomes of that research are going to be. A lot wrong with that, and I think that's the sort of dilemma that we're trying to work with. It is how do you create enough space between what you know and what you don't know for that to become an interesting
mm-hmm.
process of
mm-hmm.
inquiry. And I think we have to be fairly fleet of foot in the way we can address that question. So I think there are some lessons to be learned from the Nesta experience, but I'm not sure how sustainable that is within the kind of audit culture
mm.
of research that we now find ourselves, you know, fairly much part of.
But I think part of the responsibility of the art world, and I think this would be a brilliant responsibility for the Arts Council, and, you know, I've got a little campaign going, so I'll just share my campaign ambitions, is that I think the Arts Council should be having discussions with the Treasury and the DCMS about measurement.
Mm.
I mean, that's one thing the Arts Council could really do for the sector. But I'm not sure that... And it might result in the Arts Council itself being abolished.
Mm.
But, you know, things sometimes need to burn brightly
mm.
and then disappear.
Mm.
We tend to create these institutions and then they stay around forever, whether they're worth their salt or not.
Yeah. That's quite an interesting point to think about what the function of an art school might be.
Mm.
Does it stay around forever? Does it reinvent itself? Are there moments when you have to take stock of what it is and say, can we do something different?
I think so.
And I quite like to explore what we might think about that. Given that we have all the benefits of infrastructure at our disposal, we have fairly self-determining institutional policies, particularly an institution like ours that has a pretty good relationship with its government departments. Should we as an art school be doing something different? I think that for me kind of takes us in a full circle, really, about what might some of the imperatives be, what might some of the key issues be for creative people.
I mean, I think it brings us as well into internationalism, partly
yeah.
because as we were rethinking Nesta, which was part venture capital, part education and part creativity, and also science, technology and the arts, I thought, well, these things don't stop at Dover.
Mm.
You know, if you're selling a product, or making a piece of art or whatever it is, you don't just stop at Dover. And so Nesta wasn't doing anything internationally. And so I thought, where could we make an impact internationally in order to start expanding our horizons? And I chose leadership and internationalism for two reasons. One, because I think leaders themselves can forge new pathways, initiate new things, and empower others. But also, leaders are in a very good position to spot talent, up-and-coming talent. And so I wanted to put my efforts there. So I started reading about leadership, and I went to Amazon to see, you know, what was the latest thinking on leadership. And most of the books on there, in fact, I would say over 85 to 90% of the books on leadership were really by middle-aged white Americans who were telling us how we could pick up a book in Heathrow, get off in JFK, and make more profit for our companies. And that seemed to be the prevailing definition of leadership. And I just thought, well, that isn't how I understand leadership. And it's certainly not how I think creative people think about leadership, although your creativity may lead to some of those other things. And so I wanted to invent an international leadership program that could take on board diversity and cultural exchange, but also develop leadership in the cultural sector. And that became a groundbreaking program, which has then gone on to influence other programs. But you know, we really took people well out of their comfort zones in order to explore diversity and creativity. And I think more of our institutions need those kind of leaders.
Do you think, I mean, expanding that notion of leadership, I would suggest it's not something that is about just a kind of hierarchical leadership of an institution. It's how everybody in the institution responds to or sees themselves as part of leadership initiative.
Yeah.
In terms of, you know, all of us lead our lives in particular ways. At certain times we take control, other times we don't take control. I'm just wanting to explore that notion of leadership, not as the chief executive notion, but
mm-hmm.
whether or not we inculcate leadership in terms of both, you know, the institutional kind of framework, but also how we might consider ourselves as individuals at certain points in time taking control.
I agree with the idea that we're all leaders and we can all approach this in different ways, but I think that the reason why I come back to the institution is because in the end institutions make decisions and have wield a huge amount of power in the world in which we are. I'm doing some interesting thinking work with the Swedish government where they're trying to rethink what they call their state architecture for the support of culture. And, you know, they're asking questions around leadership. But there was a perception study done. It hasn't been done in the arts, but I'm about to try and do this in the arts. There was a perception study done in the sciences about leadership. And what they did was they photographed different leaders, science leaders, and they stopped people on the London Underground and they said, pick the science leader from these 10 people. And then they also said, here are different groups of people, in which group is the science leader? I mean, I'm sure it was more sophisticated than that, but you know, that was the impression I got of it. And the leader was actually a young Chinese physicist, a young woman Chinese physicist. And, I mean, she was deselected all the time. And I think that, you know, if we were to do the same exercise in the arts, we would probably come up with, you know, a very particular kind of leader. And, I mean, you can all imagine your own leader. But in my mind, you know, I often think of Richard Eyre, or I think of someone like Chris Smith, or John Tooser, or, you know, Nick Sirota. I mean, they're all interchangeable, really. And I think that, you know, we need to do do something about it, really.
What about art schools then? What should we do? To say it's feeling slightly, you know, the much of this. Yeah. What should we do?
Why does one do art? Why does one do art internationally? You know, I mean, then you can think about what an art school should be.
But if we pull it back to some of those key debates, which, you know, I think as a cultural sector we've pretty much failed at, actually, in terms of representation, equality, diversity. You know, it's not a great story. And do we continue to try and find ways of addressing that? Or should we be looking at a different tactic? Hence the suggestion we might decide on, instead of promoting, you know, a sort of high sense of individuality in terms of what art schools are based around, whether we should take some seriously important collective issues and say, if you want to come to this art school, this is what we're going to explore collectively as a strategy. Fairly radical.
It's very radical. Yeah, I like it.
Is there an appetite
for that? Well, I think it lets people in who might not otherwise come
exactly,
in the door.
Yeah.
But I think it does come back to why do art. I mean, we're all engaged in art and creativity for different reasons, and it would be good to hear why some people here are engaged in it. But, you know, is it because we believe in freedom of expression that says something about individual and their relationship to the world around them and the relationship to the state in which they exist? That's a very general statement, but is it about a particular thing you want to express yourself about? So is it about issues? Which means, again, you're putting the power in the hands of the individual and their ability to interpret that issue. Is it because you want to reach the most people and have the most meaning, and then you're looking for indicators of that, and that might be how many people are buying things, could be an indicator. That could take art down a particular route. It could take it down much more of a lifestyle route, and there are people who are pursuing that. If it's the gallery route, it's a very small and focused group of people you're trying to reach, who are usually more wealthy than the average. Or is it about, you know, dialogue between nations in order to achieve something together? And I mean, this is the one that motivates me very much, along with all those other things. But I think that we're at a particular time where we need to find new ways of having dialogue between nations, and art is a tremendously powerful way of both having that, but also revealing things about the character and personality and psyche or mood of a nation in a way that other methodology can't. You know, it reaches into a nation in a different way. And I think often it's those moods which are more important than actually than the facts almost. I mean, I think it's fascinating, for example, that Barack Obama is the Democratic nominee. Mm-hmm. And that's really about the mood of a nation. And, you know, 6 months ago, mm-hmm. it just didn't, you know, it wasn't there. And so, you know, I think art has a tremendous responsibility in promoting that dialogue. Because the world's I kind of see myself as a citizen of the world who happens to live in London. But the world's issues are not going to be solved by nations.
Mm. Let's open that. Plenty to go up there, I think. Let's try and make it more of a discussion now, I think. Does anybody want to come back on any of those?
I just wondered if you could say, I mean, you know, the answer to the problems of the universe, you talked about enabling formulas.
worked in, what has happened is that the institution will have targets, and these targets are all broken down and broken down until an individual has a responsibility. And the theory is that by achieving these targets, you contribute to the corporate good, and therefore you feel part of a corporate whole and sign up to the values, and you can see where the institution is going. Whereas I always think that you ought to start with the individual and say, you know, what do you want to achieve here in this institution? Because I believe that if you get the right people, they will achieve the corporate goals. And so I think that's formula, that instead of starting with a corporate plan, that actually you have the corporate plan in your head as the manager, because you know you might need to achieve some goals, but actually to motivate your staff, it's about what they want and about what they can do at that institution and then take with them into the future. So investing in your staff, that's how I interpret investing in your staff, but I'm sure that's not how most institutions interpret it.
I think that's very similar to how students might be approached, because you know, we have a curriculum which I suppose could be parallel to the institution, and we have assessment and all that kind of thing, but we talk to students, which I think does happen quite a lot anyway, about what they want to achieve and what they, where they'd like to go with their work and their process. That eventually they do get to the degree stage. I think where there's getting to be less and less space. Did you say about the space between asking the question and knowing the answer? I think that's what we've really got to keep our eye on, because that is the space that is closing. And you know, there are all the external factors that determine that. Maybe look at ways that all, you know, higher education can open those up. Now we've seen lots of things that happen, projects that have gone on in this college and some of the other colleges that students participate in, and they form their own collectives and they show their own work and do all kinds of things, but that's outside the institution. And I suppose it's a good thing that happens, but I guess what I'm saying is the structures should be there that enable that to be contained, no, you know, within the community, so that it's happening. You know about it, you can celebrate it.
Mm-hmm.
I remember when I was a postgraduate student being interviewed at Slade, Tim Haird, who was on the panel, you know, I was showing at the time as an artist, and he sort of said, well, you know, how do you feel about being here and at the Slade? Do you think you're institutionalized? And I responded by saying, well, I don't know anybody who isn't. And I think that it's a really interesting question, you know, how do you bring change at some sort of ground level in terms of an organisation that you invest a great deal of time in terms of trying to instigate dialogue, instigate conversation. I mean, I've been teaching in art schools since 1985, so that's 23 years, and at various points I was watching various colleagues, artists and curators who were But for me, I kind of stuck with it because I think that actually, you know, it is a very, very fertile ground in which some really amazing and fantastic things happen. And those things happen on very tiny scales sometimes, but collectively they begin to make, I think, what's very exciting, and that's a bigger picture. And I think that in view of, I think, what we're both saying in terms of, you know, leadership, in terms of participation, I think that I think it's really key to take on a mantle in a way if that's what you choose to do. But I also think that it's equally important to be supported within an institutional context in terms of perhaps occupying a particular interest, either through practice or through the kind of academic and intellectual playing aspect of it, which and whereby perhaps has some kind of peripheral existence. And I'm not necessarily, you know, obviously talking about the context of, you know, transcultural issues, but I'm talking about finding practice, finding language within practice that interrogates and brings about change. And, you know, I would hate to see art schools die. I think they're the most wonderful places on the planet.
Well, some of them are.
Well, some of them are complete disasters. I mean, I came from one that was one,
yeah,
actually. But, I mean, you know,
yeah,
I do think that there is place for change. I think, unfortunately, the model in many art schools today, I mean, I was at an Elliott conference in 1994, and, you know, that's 14 years on. And I have to ask, well, how much has changed?
I was about to remind you of that, actually.
Yeah. The only thing I will say is I think Roger Wilson was at that particular conference, and I think he heard me complain. And then employed me. So, I mean, you know, I don't know. But, I mean, very little has changed in the bigger picture.
Yeah. So it could be time for one, time for a change.
Well, it's a very sensitive thing.
Yeah, but I think that, you know, change is a sensitive issue, you know, and to some people, all change is bad, even though it's clearly for the better. You know, so, you know, there are enough people who will stop change happening. Really, we need to create more people who are change agents, because otherwise we support the status quo, which, you know, does nothing for most people.
We'll come back to the continuity of the art school in a minute. But
yeah, I think art school has fundamentally changed. And I agree with Shutapa in the sense that it is an enabling place. And it should really remain, it should really have the role and capacity to enable arts to change. And in one way, also, we shouldn't be too arrogant that this is the only place which has happened. There are lots of other places and other people are playing different kinds of roles. But I see just, I was teaching since late 1970s. So I have seen in three concrete ways it has changed the character fundamentally. One is the PhD in art. The other one is the HRC funding. The third one is RAE funding. Those three things have also RAE, it's interesting historically, the RAE and HRC were very different kind of assessment of art. At least it has changing. Initially when RAE funded, though it's controversial for me to say, but certainly the first RAE was basically, if you are exhibiting in a good gallery, you got good marks. So it wasn't about content itself, they didn't investigate what is that value. Whereas the research council, the research project, that goes really a peer review scrutiny. Is that actually really a proper, say, a fine art research or not? Also, whatever. And this is shifting, but basically, art schools are doing quite a different things now compared to like 25 years ago. See, and that's exciting. And also, that's now providing forum to talk to other experts like anthropologists, museum experts, literature people, dance, and digital technology. You see, and also, for example, we have some people who are working with medical profession. You see, so this is also this interdisciplinarity. So we are getting out of the little cocoons we used to be. So I think that's very exciting.
Yeah,
we
very
just
exciting.
Have to grab the opportunity.
Very exciting.
You see, and also I hope that Lab Train is, you see, you talked about people. I think the setting up of Train is in one of a top-down decision. So we had some kind of track record, so we can do that. But then our students who are just out there, they look at the website, come here and see, oh, I think that's great. And they come, apply. See, so that is, that way we are sort of cutting out certain routes and they come straight to what they want. And once they're here, now it's part of us, part of the institution. See, I think that's great.
But research is still less than 1% of the university's population.
Now what I'm saying
is
that
I think, you know, there's a context for what you're saying, which
but it's changing the character of art school. See, because in one way that's very often regarded as, so for example, if I mean sort of university league table, or what are they for, these are very often picked out as what is defining individual colleges, I think.
But are they defining them? I mean, I'll come back to the surface point. Are they defining them by more of the same? Or are they changing the paradigm? I mean, I think the issue for me is that most art schools around Europe look the same, actually. The curriculum is broadly a kind of similar kind of referencing. You know, we're about to enter degree show time. You could go to any fine art course in the country the next couple of weeks, you'll see the same shows. You'll see the same cultural referencing, you'll see the same intellectual, conceptual referencing, the same poor level of skill execution, so on and so on, and overcrowding, whatever. You know, and we'll all kind of wallow in that in our own ways. I think art schools are pretty similar across Europe, probably across North America as well.
Can
I
just
and I think the debates are very, very fixed.
Everyone,
yeah.
I just wanted to make a point to the show. I think you accept what you're saying about the expansion of provision in certain respects, particularly in terms of funding rates. I think the AHRC, RAE, and provision of PhDs, but all play a key part in that. But I think what's interesting is to know that that's happened, so sort of expanding of provision, alongside the fact that, given this is confessional time, teaching experience, for 15 years, only 15, sorry, 15,
formula, because the entry restrictions to anything will affect who enters. So one of the things I did in Leicester was I said, I don't want anyone that has, you know, qualifications don't matter. So if you don't have one O level, or whatever it is now, GCSE or whatever, you can come and work for this institution. And it caused absolute uproar, because every other team was saying, oh, but you'll devalue our brand, because we only want people with MAs to come and work here. And I said, no, because all I'm concerned is whether someone can do the job. I'm not concerned about what qualification they have. And so I'm not advocating the same thing for art schools. I'm just saying that it's an example of a formula affecting something. And my team in Leicester was the most culturally diverse team in the whole institution, because, you know, I had no restriction.
No, it's really good to hear that, in my experience, art schools don't necessarily stipulate 5 GCSEs or 2 A-levels, blah, 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 foundation. Certainly, the ones I've worked with haven't, so there's a possibility of coming in with non-traditional qualifications. But I think what's really interesting is the way in which other things get internalised by the people who are applying, so they think that's not for me, or that is for me, depending on, I guess, a really complex combination of social factors. And for me, that's the bigger problem. It's not so much institutions changing their policies to open up access, but how one internalises prohibition.
Yeah.
Well, I think that, again, you know, citing an example at the end of the day is only an example, you know, but it's not just necessarily about, in my experience, about those people who are applying to those places or to the context of an art school. I think the idea or the notion that potentially, you know, you can belong to something. I mean, my background before coming to art school was actually studying science and, you know, with a bit of geography thrown in or something. But it wasn't by any means, you know, the traditional route. But I ended up as an undergraduate feeling at interview that actually the context of discourse that was permissible at the University of Leeds was exactly what I wanted to be part of. And I think, you know, again, for example, and I'm trying to be very sensitive and discreet here at the same time, but, you know, it also has a huge problematic because art schools inevitably still are vested with so much conservatism.
Oh yeah,
and
the whole of the arts is,
you know,
not just,
I mean,
art schools.
Yeah, I mean, it's absolutely extraordinary. So you may end up having a really interesting, intelligent student who lacks confidence because they come from a particular background. And perhaps they're not encouraged by the interview panel to take hold, made to feel that they belong, and therefore they want one to come, you know. And it's a very, very slow process and a very tricky context, I think, to try and shift that dynamic. And if you begin to say, well, we're all agents, you know, it sounds a bit sort of conspiratorial in that sense, but I do think that, you know, having come from an art school that really had was an appalling art school in terms of how afraid it was of transnational discourse, actually, and how, you know, manipulative certain members of staff were in trying to stamp out the possibility of that kind of dialogue. I mean, in a way, it becomes emblematic of, I'm sure, many of the things that are happening up and down the country still, sadly, in art schools.
I mean, when I started teaching, I was unusual at the start. I had to tick in the year list of, the only thing I could tick was black. Now you have sort of like age mixation or whatever. See? But for example, when I started teaching, most of the students were home teenagers. Now, more than half of the students are mature students. That means more than 2-3 years. one-third of the student are non-home students.
Mm-hmm.
See, I think that's a huge environmental change.
Mm-hmm.
We forget.
Mm-hmm.
It was like that
mm-hmm.
in the 70s.
Mm-hmm.
And so we have to realize that, I know there's conservatism there and so on, but in one way we have to be aware of the changes.
Yeah.
And also, just as you say, it's an enabling mechanism so that these old people come in and they do great things. We have to provide a forum that can happen.
Okay, we'll come back to that in a second.
Yeah. I want to come back to the point where you said all over Europe, as schools are almost the same. I don't agree, I must say, because
good,
I have experience in three different European countries. I studied in Paris and the sort of Germany. I'm here now with Train, invited as
she's
a
our artist in residence from
Berlin.
Okay.
And I also had an experience in New York at the Whitney program, which
yeah.
is, I think, a very sort of you know, historical program in terms of how they embrace theory and diversity, etc. My experience in Germany was awful. Now, coming from Paris to Germany, I must say that at that time and still now, it's a very different system than here.
Mm-hmm.
I can be
yeah.
really lucky
yeah.
with what we have here.
Mm-hmm.
In Germany, it's still a system where, in most of the art schools, there's the master, and you study 5 years with your master. And you sort of try to not imitate him too much, but on the other hand, they all do. And in Düsseldorf, where I was, which is a really prestigious art school, they're extremely anti-technology. They're very sort of, they had computers offered and they refused it because they thought we are here. They're sort of trying to repeat a 19th century model. You know?
Why does anyone go there?
Yeah, that's a good question.
Well, I should have qualified my comments. I mean,
it's a good question, and
yeah.
I think the school has also changed. I mean, during the time when Pipe was there, and Beuys was there, and Gerhard Richter, etc., mm-hmm. it was maybe a little bit more progressive. But then with Markus Lüppertz as a painter at the head of the school, it tremendously changed in a different, more conservative direction. And
mm-hmm.
coming from Paris, I had a different approach to the art, much more theory oriented, much more technology oriented, much more diverse than its students. And I must say that's something that has changed here, I think. This the thing that Tosha said, it's wonderful and fantastic that artists can do PhDs now, because it also says that you want artists to think. While in Germany, very often, there's still this model that
mm-hmm.
artists should do something and not think.
Yeah. Well, I take your point. I would still say, possibly with the exception of Germany, which I know well, I know the schools well that you're talking about. You know, they've decided that they don't want to be part of the Bologna process. They, you know, they want to base their teaching philosophy on a 19th century atelier system. I'm very familiar with the German art school position. I think, you know, if you look at the rest of Europe, then I would stand by what I said. Really, I think there are huge similarities of the way curriculum is formed, the way students are selected, or in many cases excluded from selection, to do with some notion of inherent and latent creativity, however that's measured. And I think also, more crucially, most art schools look inwards and not outwards. The debates are often, you know, highly focused conceptually, but they're internally facing debates, and there's seldom a real sense of those debates being useful outside of the academy, as it were. And I think something that research does, and I come back to Tosha's point about what the research culture, be it a small part of universities or art schools, is doing, is actually taking those debates externally.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's the bit that I'm really quite interested
mm.
in, as a sort of conduit or permeability of the institution. I think most art schools are not permeable institutions. They're hard to get into, and once you're inside them, they're actually hard to have a debate that actually... they're actually hard to externalise those debates.
And why do people never move on? I mean, one of the questions I ask about art institutions generally is, you know, why do people never move on? There should be a limited tenure for people.
Well, we've heard claims of conservatism, you know,
no,
Can I just add to what you were saying about the inside as well? As I think that my perception is, and I was at a, did my MA at a college in the north of England, and I remember that we were absolutely actively told that we weren't eight, this was in 1981, and we were actually told that we weren't allowed to bring anything from the outside into the art school at all, and so their photographs, any reference to any external discourses weren't allowed in the studio space at all. And I mean, thank God that position has shifted, but in a sense, I think what I sort of concur that extent that Chris says is that the college does look, colleges do look outside now, but it's a kind of folding in process. It's kind of opened its doors, but then it's kind of like pulled the outside inside, and I don't think it really is become an externalized kind of debate at all. I think it's appropriated an external debate to look as though they're addressing things, but I don't think it actually is an external debate.
Okay. Helen.
Well, I'm thinking back also to what you said about back to the National, to South Bank, is that what you feel now, that it's not just a space, and that it was about building relationships with the community. And I think we've kind of got into a mindset of the BA degree, for example, being ending or something. And really, and you know, and if it's true that the schools are similar and the kind of work that we see is similar, I think that's, you know, that's really just the beginning, and that what would be interesting to see is where people are 10 years, for example, 5 years, 10 years down the line, and what we're not very good. Well, I suppose to some extent we are fairly good at, you know, we get a lot of people who, you know, visiting artists talking and that kind of thing, but what we're not very good at is keeping some kind of relationship going with the community of artists that are.
We don't yet understand enough about networks in the arts. We think we do because we all go to parties and we all have our own back books, but that's not a sophisticated management of networks. There's a whole area of management and exploring and maximising networks that we need to learn more about.
A little bit about the future. I mean, we've all got our horror stories of the past, you know, probably some of the present, but I mean, how would we think about creating, for instance, something like a graduate school that embodied research centres, research students, postgraduate programmes? And we populated that with people who, both individually and collectively, we're in agreement about what some of the main concerns and issues of our time were that artists and designers and thinkers should and could be addressing. And we just let those people in and nobody else.
Wouldn't it have to be people who disagree? Wouldn't that be more exciting?
I'm talking about, you know, fairly inclusive thematic
yeah.
processes,
yeah.
Not niche.
Yeah, okay.
but you know,
climate change, for example,
environment, climate change, faith, conflict, identity. Some of the things which some of us would you know, we'd get behind a banner on the street behind if our lives were threatened, but we wouldn't necessarily see them as being core things which we dealt with in our lives.
Quite interesting when you were talking, and we've got used to that, using a word like change.
Yeah.
Because it hangs in the air as a sort of depoliticised way of referring to what in other eras would have maybe been looked at more politically.
Mm-hmm.
And I think maybe we've got a bit scared of talking about the politics of our activities, and that
mm-hmm.
the art school traditionally has been a place that has glorified its the notion of unconventionality and thinking differently and trying to, you know, it might not have really happened, but that was what was supposed to be allowed to happen. And I think maybe now we somehow or other we all pretend that there is no politics within our activities, and maybe something like that, where you actually declare that we're changing something for a reason.
Mm.
We're not just changing because of a policy or a strategy, but we're changing because of a set of beliefs.
And also, I basically think most of us lack courage for change and lack courage to challenge or stand up for our beliefs. And that's a very difficult thing for an individual to accept. And that's why when you see a student standing in front of a tank, you just, you know, you think, would I have the courage to do that? And most of us wouldn't. And when we're never in those extreme situations, or we're hardly ever in those extreme situations in our society, and so we're not forced to confront, you know, fundamental issues.
Sort of something. Something also about the fact that there's this massive schism within modernism and beyond around the role of art, social role of art, which is to do with art separate, autonomous. Art separate, autonomous, but actually useful in that role, art is politically engaged. And I think the art school is sort of still not sure where it sits on that.
Mm-hmm.
But it seems to me that actually what we're collectively doing maybe is rather nicely burying our heads in the sand, to speak for myself maybe, because actually the things that confront us are absolutely apocalyptic. You know, climate change, massive recession, global instability. I mean, how does art, what does art do in the face of all of that? And isn't there some sort of hubris in actually trying to say, all right, these are the issues, we're going to take them on? And actually there's something quite potentially meaningful or purposeful in actually having that enclave separate. I'm now espousing a position I don't really believe in.
One of the things that I was doing in the Innovation Unit at the Sandbank Centre was saying, what are the big issues that will connect to the public? And through them, can we connect people to art? Rather than going down the access route of cheaper tickets. Because there are many ways to encourage access, and I was trying to encourage thought access, which I believe will lead to engagement with art for good reason. And, you know, so for example, if we've had an earthquake, it will affect everybody, and it will affect art. And, you know, you see that in interpretations of. Well, so the way our society is governed affects us all, and the man in the street can relate to that. And therefore, if our arts organisations are openly declaring that we're dealing with these things, there's a greater chance of engagement, I believe. But when you try to actually embed that in formula or the way an organisation is run, you come up against all kinds of things. Like a small example again. A lot of talk about access. So I went to the Department of Culture, Media and Sport and I said, okay, why don't you give us £100,000 to spend on art, but we'll let the public decide how it's spent, and we'll do 10 small projects, and we'll run, and we'll have curators who are judging the same applications, but they don't make the decisions, the public does. Because at that point, there's a lot of debate about the lottery and inclusivity and who's making the decisions, and the Secretary of State was saying we want to involve the public but we don't want to devolve decision making.
Mm-hmm.
So I said, well look, you don't take the risk, let us play with that idea and we'll let people make the decision. Well, the curators were in uproar. I mean, the £100,000 didn't even exist. It was fictional money. But it was like, well, you're taking away our power. But there wasn't the ability to see that actually a small experiment like that could increase the power of this institution. No, I mean, you see, the problem is that I'm not very knowledgeable about the visual arts world. So what I should have done is probably come to a school like this and said, you know, what would you make of this idea? But, you know, in those days, you know, I wasn't thinking about engaging. I was thinking about the theory of it. And when I had the £100,000, I might have thought about, okay, now what do I do with it? But that's the point. We only ever seem to go halfway. We've got to be much braver with our interventions. And that's why I really like this idea. You know, let's do this, let's take this, let's make this paradigm shift. So what if it doesn't work? It's only a couple of million. I mean, it really, in the great scheme of things, it's nothing.
I feel like, I think we've hardly used the word artist, we've used the word arts, sort of organisational structures and institutions.
Mm.
So there was something earlier on in your talk where you were interested in getting sort of grassroots, and yet the project you've just mentioned, I'm sure you've done other sorts of projects, the project was much more about going to the public and doing sort of an audience-centred approach, and that really frustrates me. I think they're great schemes, but as an artist that frustrates me, because then as an artist, what then, you know, the way you encounter those projects is suddenly you're being asked to do something in relationship to what the public wants, which for me is sometimes it works out, sometimes it's really difficult, sometimes I'm the wrong artist, you know, I mean, it's the wrong choice of artist.
Well, sorry, I don't the public applying themselves, you know, and a citizen's jury making the decision.
Yeah.
Sorry,
yeah.
I didn't mean. Let the public draw up the brief and then get an artist to just come and carry it out.
Okay, fine. That's, I suppose it still sort of stands in there. It's like, how do artists have any impact? And even in the institution, in terms of, I've been teaching for a couple of years, and I feel quite incapacitated really by being in the institution. I don't know how to have any effect other than to kind of carry out certain sort of structures that are in place. There doesn't seem to be a place where people coming in, who are artists, practitioners coming in to the institution, can actually affect any change. And then the other thing is, like, you're on a residency here, and I just think the artists in residence, or an artist in residence, they should be housed in the space and visible, and the practice should be visible. Artists doing research in institutions, and this is not just, you know, it's just artists in institutions, educational institutions, who are doing research, somehow or other the art practice is left at home or left in their studio. And it's not, I find it really difficult to sort of access what's happening in
how
the space. Yeah, I mean, it's sort of left at.
How is it visible?
It's happening, but it's not. It's not facilitated, perhaps, in a way. It's sort of like, you know, what does an artist need to practice and sustain themselves? They do need money, they need space, and whether or not, you know, perhaps a lot of the PhD routes and the research routes are just ways of sustaining your practice, but outside of the institution.
Well, could come back to your first point, and without wanting to sound obvious, coming into an art school, whoever it is who comes through the door, comes into a place of learning. Therefore, there's some kind of notional process or contractual process that the institution itself has some responsibility for how it negotiates that process of learning, and that can be different at different levels. And I'm aware that process of negotiated learning. I would kind of premise the notion that it's still a learning experience. We as an institution still retain, for better or worse, a sense of judgment about people's learning. And I think that gives the institution a responsibility to address some of the questions you're asking. It equally gives you a responsibility. You know, the art school is not just a place for artists to come and be expressive.
Mm.
It's a place where there's some kind of contractual process that is understood and that is about a certain kind of negotiation. And I think many of the issues that you and other people are alluding to is possibly to do with the institution itself not always being clear about what it is trying to achieve collectively and individually in relation to people who are in a kind of contractual arrangement with it. And that's about teaching, that's about direction, and it's about being part of a community of learning.
I'd just like to say something about that, if I can, very quickly. Sorry. I mean, when I'm here, in some sort of way, sometimes you sort of feel that was a sort of cul-de-sac to me. You know, you sort of went in and you came right back out, and it was a big sort of boomerang effect. But most of the time, I have to say, I always feel that there's something either I've learned or that somebody I'm in conversation with has learned. And I just think that it has a great deal to do with the context of support and agency and willingness of to engage and also to give you some free rein to respect and regard your artistic and your intellectual kind of knowledge, if you like, and input, and allow you to go about, you know, engaging those kinds of discussion in a way that does make shift. And perhaps it's because I am an optimist, but I do believe that those things are real.
There's a couple of points that were made, and it just occurred to me, thinking about the space, actually spaces of discussion, spaces for forum. And it reminded me of an interview that I'd heard with Umberto Eco, where he was talking about the nature of European, particularly Italian universities, compared to, say, British universities, where you're talking about community of interest, and he was talking about British universities predominantly are on the periphery, they're on these campuses outside of the town. Whereas an Italian university, the university is actually right dead in the centre of the city. And that makes the university very much part of all the cultural, political, and social dynamics of that city and that community. And next to that, Echo wasn't talking about this, but I'm kind of making an extension of this, is one of the very interesting things about Italian cities, the core of the Italian city is the piazza. And that the piazza is the space against, it's a central focus where people come and meet. It's always been there since Roman times. And the sense it's the public space, the shared space, people come and meet there. For drinking, for talking, for political reasons, cultural reasons. We don't have that kind of space in Britain. The nearest we probably have is the pub or the village green, in a sense. But by extension, we also don't have this kind of space in the universities. Often, not always. But I mean, this, I'm talking about our college here, for example. I work at Goldsmiths. And I was talking about actually the need for converting one of our studios into a common room. Because actually I thought that would actually have a greater importance than having a studio space. Because it would bring people together. It would be a space of discussion, a forum. We don't have that here at Chelsea. We have this canteen. That's not the same. But you need a physical space to bring people together. I don't know if the parade ground is going to become a piazza, but, you know, but you see the point that I'm trying to make. You physically need
just universities and colleges.
Yes.
I mean, it's really interesting, the whole Thames Gateway development, right? There's not a cultural, there's no cultural space, isn't it? It's just houses.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, talk about not learning from the mistakes of the 60s.
Mm.
You know, and they seem to think by putting a community centre there, it's also an art space, it kind of doubles up. I mean, how the ghastly civic community spaces that, yeah, they're just dreadful for artists. And, you know, so I think your observation has wider resonance. It's not just about universities. I mean, we had McDonald's. Do you know what those are? You know, in those back-to-back houses in Yorkshire and mining towns, there were the backgunnels, whatever they were called. And that's where lots of problems got solved. And all there was the community washhouse,
mm-hmm.
where people would go, all the public baths. And these were all spaces where people mix and mingle, and where we are much more isolated now, where society is fragmented. And so, I think where are those spaces? And they are spaces for conflict resolution, for inquiry, for exchange, for development. They're just not there.
Or conflict provocation.
Yeah, or conflict provocation. But we have the internet, so we can do it virtually.
But it's also a topic that artists have been approaching for the last 10, 15 years a lot, like the privatization of the public space.
Mm. Roads which will now become security zones, and now people are waking up to this, and different rules apply in those spaces than on public thoroughfares. Well, you know, where's all the debate about public spaces gone? It's obviously within the walls of art schools. There's not interaction between art schools and other disciplines.
Exactly.
You know, so far from just single discipline courtyards, you know, you need multidiscipline courtyards and interdiscipline courtyards.
That's exactly what these practices are engaging with.
Yeah.
Social spaces, cultural spaces, gardening spaces.
And then turn them outwards and share what you've got.
Initially, it was looking at how the spaces within the University of the Arts are used for teaching, and it got into whole kinds of discussions about the nature of the disciplines that we're teaching and the approaches and values of teaching and so on, perceptions of how students learn and that kind of thing. But one thing that comes up over and over again is the idea of having these social spaces for learning. I know, again, when I was at art school, we got sort of a cubbyhole kind of thing, and the person I had shared this cubbyhole with. Constantly sort of moving things onto the other person's space, you know, like we were encroaching on each other's space. Whereas, you know, in Chelsea, certainly, there's much more of an open studio space where everybody can see
my sense of the graduate school is it's a fairly sort of elusive Blancmange type thing. That it exists more virtually than actually.
Yes.
That it could actually, you know, have a seminar at a tube station,
mm-hmm.
or it could have an event at the Royal Festival Hall, or it could do something in here,
yeah.
or it could have an internet relationship with a school somewhere in Australia. I think for me, the kind of bricks and mortarness of institutions are part of the problem. But come back to your point.
I agree, and I quite like Bettina's idea of art school as kind of think tank,
mm-hmm.
and that is certainly in a modest way also happening. For example, I haven't actually had email of everybody, but for example, if I can just blow my out trained trumpet because it's my own forum kind of thing, is that we just got money from the Dialogue Foundation, £10,000,
mm-hmm.
in collaboration with train UCL, Aoyama Gakuin University in Tokyo. And this autumn, a team of us are going there, and it's interestingly, it's about the urban environment, London and Tokyo, and in fact, the workshops are not just simply on art school or in research base, but we are inviting like the civil servants of the Shibuya Ward, which is like Westminster
mm-hmm.
equivalent,
mm-hmm.
and they are the sort of actually that directly involved with urban environment policy.
Yeah.
You see? And then we are going to talk to them about maybe London Gardens.
Mm.
Yeah.
You see? So there's that kind of exchange, and we are also going to make a film so that it will be just now also filmed to the general public
mm.
of the Shibuya Award. You see? So that will be a function as a kind of think tank for them to burst out of the little enclave of the Shibuya.
Yeah.
So that
yeah.
we can, and again, it's not just us, but also UCL is
sure.
partner. See, that way I think we can contribute in a modest way. I mean,
mm-hmm.
£10,000
yeah.
is not big money, but
mm-hmm.
at least we got it.
Yeah.
Interesting. The next thing that would be really interesting was if you became a civil servant.
I'm only 2 years ago.
Might not be really interesting.
Yeah.
No, I mean, it would be interesting for
yeah.
us as
some
a society.
Some of my students.
Yeah.
Are you saying
it? Have we got any more formal contributions, otherwise you might sort of collapse into a more.
I have one question. I wonder what you thought. I know that there's been some criticism of the Arts Council, and inevitably through time there have always been interesting individuals who try to work or operate within those kinds of contexts. But I wondered what your observation thoughts were about the context of the ex-director of visual arts at the Arts Council now being involved with the RAE panels that, you know, are attached much more to the arts corps, the institutional kind of setup. I wondered if that was something that you might comment on. So in other words,
is that Marjorie?
Yes.
Well,
I'm just curious about how you see that relationship and what you feel.
Well, it comes as no surprise,
mm-hmm.
given that both institutions are heavily bureaucratised, that the transference of one to the other would be almost seamless, I think.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, less cynically, I would say that one would hope that it might actually bring a different imperative to the decision-making process, not based so much on the kind of internal academic discourse, but actually a broader cultural discourse. Whether that particular individual can carry that responsibility, I'm not sure.
Because I think actually, probably the only person who's actually on that panel, but not on that panel, I know how they're appointed, is that again, RA is a pure sort of research-oriented thing, but they're always conscious that we just don't talk shop. So we are always asked to get so-called people from the industry,
mm-hmm.
you see, and for like art and design would be that kind of quantum type of people. They are sort of related but not edgy.
Mm-hmm.
See, so like in our artist panel, we have had a researcher DNA. She's brought in as one of those so-called external view.
Mm-hmm.
And that's very much, but then again, whether that particular person is appointed or not,
single quango that is responsible for funding the arts. And I think, for example, at Nesta we were interdisciplinary, we funded a filmmaker, the UK Film Council went mad. I mean, why on earth are you funding a filmmaker? You know, I think there are issues, and also I'm engaging in a bit of research, I don't know what the outcome's going to be, but what it is looking at is certain individuals and the position they occupy on boards of quangos. Because I think it's a very small number of people who have a grip on what happens in our cultural policy. And I want to find out, I can guess, but I want the data that tells me who they are, what is their social background. Because, you know, this is how change is made when you disrupt these patterns. And I think there is a danger that people just go from one thing to another. But we only let it happen. I mean, we all let it happen. And, you know, if we disagree with it, we should write about it, we should talk about it, publicise it.
Start a series of discussions. Yeah, that's meant to be. That's exactly the right sort of. If you can just, we haven't just said enough, kind of thing. That's the moment to stop. And I'd like to thank both of you for really having a great discussion.
Fascinating.
Yeah. And please do join us later as well.
Thank you.
In the later discussion.
Yes,
so thank you.
Yeah.
And thank you very much.
Christopher Fraley.
How
many minutes of meetings will you have seen that said apologies are made due to conflict of interest?
No.
You know, endless conflicts of interest.
Thank you very much. That was fascinating. Actually, I don't think anyone. This went up. The conversation went on much longer with more people talking than usual.
Yeah.
I'm sorry. We weren't huge numbers tonight, but on the other hand.
I think this kind of discussion is bound to kind of atomise, isn't it? Because it starts to touch on social architecture, on city planning, on how demographics work. And it's a complex set of relationships, really. You can't kind of put them all into one.
There was nothing formulaic, you know, everyone was actually.
Yeah.
I think your point about Nesta and interdisciplinarity goes back to the point I was saying about when you get some of the Indian, Japanese, you get people talking who know they don't know about something.
Yes, yes.
They know about one thing but not something else. And so that's where you
just
get this
really
engagement where a set of ideas are
represented.
Exactly, and I'm in this world where everyone knows everyone, and it's all.
So,
as soon as you can get to a situation where
CCW
admits that they don't know,
just that bit you go to,
I know that is a brand.